Here we are, we've done it, we're at the last part of the day, and I want to introduce William Large.
Hello.
Hello. William is a reader in continental philosophy and course leader in religion, philosophy and ethics at the University of Gloucestershire. I was going to get to the Shire at the very end of it. Yeah. He lectures on, he's preoccupied with the history of philosophy and the limits of morality, atheism and scientific truth. He's the author of four books, focusing upon Blanchot, Levinas and Heidegger, and is currently working on a book on atheism.
Etherism, that's a better book.
That could be the follow-up. He was elected by the trustees as a Royal Fellow of the Royal Society of Arts in 2009, and from 2010 to 14, he was president of something called the British Society of
Those
Phenomenology.
Those are my great years, ranting at Patrick over the phone about banks.
And he's going to talk today on Before Language, There Is Language.
Yeah, thanks for that. The book on Blanchot I wrote with Uli. So I want to say that. So I didn't write just by myself. So what I'm going to talk about is it's very weird, because when you give the last paper, your paper you've written becomes increasingly less believable to you as you progress through the day. Until you get to think, Jesus, what a load of I've just written. Now, one of the things I think is that when I wrote my little thing last week, I kind of was felt a bit irritated with Cormac McCarthy. But I think I'm convinced, and especially listening to everybody else, I think he's being a little bit more playful than I actually when I first read him. I think I read him in a bit too serious way. So you'll have to forgive me for that. Now, basically, and I have never met Dan, and we've never spoken, as far as I know. So there's no collusion here, but I find it bizarre that, in some sense, my paper follows from yours, though yours is going to be less sophisticated and beautiful than yours. Is what basically my problem with him, and I'm talking about just this paper. I mean, I have read his novels, but purely for pleasure, never in an academic context. Is that I don't understand why he didn't write about the unconscious in terms of free indirect discourse. Basically, I'm going to argue for you is that the unconscious is free indirect discourse. So I think I don't understand, well, as a writer, why he didn't approach it that way, you know, what Dan was talking about previously. Now, free indirect discourse, very, you know, I just say, what is free indirect discourse? Somebody speaking to someone, narrated by someone whom you don't know, or narrator has no name. And I want to say, well, that's the unconscious. Why does he have to think of the unconscious in terms of the visible? Why go it that way? Because I think if you do that, there are real problems to the level of method. So, and what I mean, what I'm going to say to you, why is that? What I'm saying is that, and this comes out from reading, there's key text for me here when I'm thinking about this. That is that there is Blanchot's essay called Speaking is Not Seeing. But I'm also interested in how that actually goes back to Rosenzweig, what we were talking about, and Rosenzweig's notion of what he's called speech thinking, which essentially is speaking is not what is spoken about, that important distinction in Rosenzweig. And also very interested how Deleuze uses that Blanchot essay, of course removes any trace of Levinas, but uses that essay to think about Foucault, especially in the way of thinking about the difference between the sayable and the visible. Now, what's very important in Deleuze's way of reading Foucault is Deleuze wants to say you can't collapse the sayable into the visible. Speaking is speaking, speaking to speaking. The visible world does not speak. You know, they're completely different, to use, I suppose, Deleuze's language, completely different regions or strata, or if you want to use an ontological language, completely different regions of being. Yeah, so the question then becomes is, well then, how does the visible and the sayable compose? And as Deleuze says in a late essay on Foucault, well, there has to be a schema. It goes back to Kant. There has to be something that draws these two different regions, if you like, to compose together. And for that, he says, there must be like what he calls in the essay, I think, and I'm quoting from memory, he calls them zones of exteriority, I think is the word he uses. The problem with Cormac's way he set it up is there's no schema in his essay. So there must be a third thing, something, that allows these, allows the visible and the sayable to compose. And there's nothing, I didn't see anything. So you can correct me if you think there is something. I'm just talking about his essay, not his literature. There might, the answer might be there. What I want to say, the suggestion I want to say is that he should have thought of the unconscious, okay? He should have thought of the unconscious in terms of free and direct discourse, not in terms of metaphors of visibility. I just don't really understand why he did it that way. And that when we're talking about what Deleuze calls zones of exteriority, then the zones of exteriority of speaking is free and direct discourse. What Blanchot calls the neuter, or le dehors, the outside. You know, I always say that Foucault was really interested in the outside, not discourses, in some sense. You know, what in some sense is always rumbling beneath discourses, which in some sense means they're never whole. They're always in some sense shattered, although they present themselves as being complete. So that's it. You know, so I don't know why at the time, and this is the one I feel a little bit more less certain about, is I kind of thought there's kind of I don't know if I should say this, but it's late at night, so I can just talk crap now. There's a lot of, you know, where white, middle-aged, white old men saying to each other how great they are. I thought, you know, and I just thought, there's a little bit too much worship of science in this. You know, and I had a quick peek at the Santa Fe Institute. I don't know if you ever looked at it. Well, it's a lot of middle-aged white men. Yeah, and there's not one philosopher on that faculty. Now, that might say about us philosophers that how appallingly bad we are now at communicating beyond our specialisms, that nobody in the slightest bit is interested in anything we say. So if I met Cormac, I said, I think you need, you know, maybe a little bit more philosophy. Okay, so the first bit is, you know, a bit of a Heidegger whine, to tell you the truth. Then it gets to a bit of Rosenzweig, but all this is very hidden, you know, so I don't talk about it, it's all there, but I just speak it. And then finally to a bit of, you know, Donnie's favourite, Blanchot. So, science is essentially projective. It does not collect facts about the world that lie about like pebbles on a beach. It already understands the world in a certain way. From Galileo onwards, it understands the world through mathematics. Numbers are not found in things, nor are numbers things. Rather, things must be brought to numbers to be counted. Science already projects nature as quantifiable, and for this reason, measures it. What is at the heart of Galileo's free fall experiment, or Newton's law of inertia, for example, is a certain projection of time and space. They are both considered to be homogeneous. Everywhere is the same. It is a coordinated system in which things are located. The object of physics, therefore, is the lawfulness of motion. This object, you can hear the phenomenologist coming out in me, this object is the result of a mathematical projection. It is not given. If you accept that science is a projection, then you must also admit, and you might not admit this, is inherently violent. It is violent because it always seeks to limit the world. What is true is not what appears, but what fits the projection. It does not let things be, but manipulates them. Science puts nature into the hands of humanity to be used up. What is outside of science is nothing. For the scientist, color is a light wave. Colors, as perceived by someone who is walking in the woods, are meaningless. They do not exist. The scientist shrinks the world to fit the experiment. There can be no scientific understanding of this decline, which is a kind of nihilism, because science conceals it. The two sciences that Cormac McCarthy uses in his essay are biology and linguistics. He understands the unconscious biologically and language linguistically. It is because he understands them through different sciences that he opposes one to the other. The unconscious is the brain, and language is a virus that somehow infects it. Both are projections and therefore reductions. The origin he seeks isn't an origin that belongs to the world, but to a model that represents the world. Indeed, I would say there isn't an origin here at all. The need for an origin is supplied by the model that it cannot answer, like imagining what existed before the universe, or what was said before anyone spoke. Now, you think you should be recollecting the antinomies in Kant's First Critique. Most sensible linguistics, I love the way I added the word sensible there. Most sensible linguists know that linguistics is a model. It does not describe what language is, but is a useful experimental hypothesis about language. We do not have to accept the scientific projection of language as true, and everything else is meaningless. Just as my experience of the leaf in the forest is not less true than the scientific explanation of it, then my reading of the word on the page is not less true than the description of a universal grammar. I feel I shouldn't have written the next sentence, but I'm going to say it anyway, and you can shout at me. Nothing that McCarthy writes, well, in this essay, I think, explains literature, which is surprising considering he's a writer. It is not that if we knew more about the brain or language, we would understand literature more, but that this way of understanding has nothing to say. It completely misses the point. As much as if somewhere someone were to explain the meaning of a novel by measuring the dimensions of the physical book, or by analyzing the results of an electroencephalogram. I always have a real problem with that word. One is an object and the other is an experience. And an experience is lost as soon as you describe it from the outside as though it were an object for a third person. If we think about language, then we can think of it as an object, which is what linguistics does. But it is also the activity of speaking. Creativity lies in speaking, but it is not the same as the imagined objective origin of a hypothetical model. Speaking cannot be represented. When I say speaking cannot be represented, I do not mean that people don't try and represent it, just as they attempt to represent thinking. But the representation is already a projection, so speaking is lost. If we were to describe it, we wouldn't find it. It would be like sand falling through our fingers. Literature is a kind of speaking. There is no origin in literature, because there is only language before language. Blanchot writes about Kafka discovering literature when for the first time he writes he rather than I in a sentence. Blanchot adds, that it is not sufficient to replace one pronoun by the other, but in this substitution, you open yourself to a language that no one speaks. It speaks rather than you or I speak. This endless swirling of words, the narrator of Beckett's The Unnameable calls it, in which every voice is lost, You could hear it in the endless chatter on the streets. It was going on before we ever got there. Speaking replies to speaking. Speaking speaks to speaking. Free indirect discourse, someone speaking to someone about something that someone else said, narrated by another who is not named, is not secondary to direct discourse, but first. We always already find ourselves in words that others have spoken, whom we do not know. Even when we think we are speaking for the first time, like the myth of Adam, naming the creatures in the Garden of Eden. Before Adam spoke, there was already an endless stream of words. To write is to bring this language to the light of day. I've got a nice little Talmudic story about this, which allows me to practice my only Hebrew that I can remember. And it makes me sound like I know Hebrew, but when my rabbi taught me Hebrew, he said, just learn one sentence in Hebrew and just recite it into your head all the time. But I was so lazy that I only learned the first line of the Bible, which goes as follows. Bereshit bara Elohim, God, I forgot the name of God then. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. Now, the interesting Talmudic reading of that by Rashi, the great 11th century Talmudist, is that in classical Hebrew, you have what is called an object marker, which tells you, which is of course very important to the first sentence of the Bible, that God is doing the creating, not the heavens. So that's that little word et. It doesn't mean anything, it's a grammatical function. It tells you the next noun is the object, not the subject. Now, actually et is Aleph Tev, which is the first and last letters of the Hebrew alphabet. So the Talmudic reading is, the first act of creation was to create language. Subsequently, then, to create the heavens and the earth. So God first created language, then, yeah. So the first act of language was not Adam naming the birds, whatever. It was God creating language. So before Adam spoke, there was language. I think Cormac McCarthy confuses this language, free indirect discourse, with the visible outside of language. And it confuses, I think, because this language that I'm talking about, free indirect discourse, isn't spoken by anyone. I just don't know what I think, and that's the unconscious. He imagines it as a kind of pictorial imagination of the unconscious, somehow older than the language of thought. Language has no immediate relation to the visible in this way. This is where I disagree with Cormac. I don't understand. Language does not have a relation to the visible in this way. It is impossible to imagine how these different regimes would communicate to one another in the way that he describes them. It is true that I speak about the world, but I only do so through what others have spoken to each other about what someone else said. Not because the visible is directly speaking to me. The world is changed through my speech and my speech through the world, but they don't stand to each other as static opposites. There is always a composition of the world and sense, but they compose precisely because they are not the same. Like many writers before him, Cormac McCarthy has been seduced by the world of spirits and seances. He thinks the world is communicating to him directly through his unconscious. He has only made it respectable because he has clothed it in the vocabulary of biology and linguistics. But he is speaking a myth. Thanks.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Will.
You're welcome.
We'll now do our little transition phase, our O'Connor questions session it's like an airlock between going from one domain to another to the question. There we go. So first question to you. I wanted to ask you about your point on science, your claim about if you accept that science is a projection, then you must also admit that it's inherently violent. Okay, so just to ask you to expand on this point, but from a certain perspective, so let's accept science is a projection, and let's also admit it is inherently violent. But isn't also philosophy, isn't also literature, art, isn't anything that is a projection that tries to work and carve space on the world inherently violent in that space? And aren't the objections you're, in a sense, having here with McCarthy's process in the essay inherent in any kind of endeavour?
Yeah, I suppose I'm so Heideggerian about these things that it's very hard for me to think outside of that. So I just think that when Heidegger says science doesn't think, I don't think he means that as a criticism of science. I think he means that if science did think, it wouldn't be science. So there are points when science gets into crisis that it has to think. If you're trying a Kuhnian perspective, you say some kind of paradigm starts collapsing and nobody really knows anymore what they're talking about or whether the reality of the objects they talk about exist. Then I suppose science, in a certain sense, starts thinking. What I mean when I say it's violent is that the violence goes in two ways. That science only works by being reductive. That's how the models function. No, it's not that projection is something that happens to science. It can't be science without projecting. You know, if you think of a very crude way, you know, Galileo's freefall experiment, what does he have to get rid of, you know, to make that model work?
Now, I take your point on all that, but I kind of want to turn the question around and ask you, well, how does art escape that, and how does philosophy escape that? I think you've answered the philosophy question is Heidegger.
Yeah, because I think that if I was going to defend philosophy, is that you can talk about violence in a very abstract way. So, well, everything is violent. And then I kind of think, well, then what, you're saying nothing. So I want to say, well, you know, what I want to say is that, well, there's a kind of violence in science which is specific to science and belongs to its essence. Whereas I would say that philosophy and writing, literature, is, for me, if it has a kind of authenticity, must be open to what Deleuze writes about in his essay, his late essay on Foucault, what he calls these zones of exteriority. So, in literature, I see that as a practice of a writer who opens themselves up to what narratologists call free and direct discourse. Which, you know, if writers are being honest, is really hard. You know, it's not imposing yourself upon free and direct discourse,
this is
letting
beautiful.
It speak it's, through you.
It's like we've rehearsed this, because my next question is indeed on free indirect discourse.
Right.
That's where I want to finish up. And of course, it links up with the paper that we had before from Dan. And it was the thing that really jumped out at me when I looked, when you were delivering this. So we've got your definition. I think there's probably a number of definitions you could do of free indirect discourse. But I actually want to turn, so we don't lose the books, I want to turn to Cormac McCarthy's writing.
Yeah.
I think when I first read Blood Meridian, that was what jumped out at me. This is free and direct. This is like the one hates to use the word example, but the most beautiful use of free and direct discourse I've ever come across, I think, in non-translated writing. You get the idea of these characters that just erupt from the ground and fall back again. The way in which sentences are constructed will allow shooting between different viewpoints, bringing archaeology in. And I just wish you'd be interesting to hear. You've criticised the philosophy essay. Wouldn't mind if there's anything you would like to affirm about the way in which Cormac McCarthy actually does his writing and approaches these problems through free and direct. So I want you to give me us a little cheery bit before we go into the questions.
Yeah, I mean, the bit I did read at the beginning is how I wept when I read Cormac McCarthy's Road. I mean, the way I came up to Cormac McCarthy is that a friend of mine, Lars Eyre, we were in an airport in America, and he said about, oh yeah, you should read that because it'll make you cry, The Road. I didn't know much about him at the time. I knew of his name, of course. And then I didn't read it on the plane, and it didn't make me cry. On the goddamn plane, sobbing in front of all these people. So what I wanted to say that because it was made me saying, look, I am just going to be writing about this one particular essay, as though it abstract it from his writing. And my little pal was saying, look, I haven't, my relation to comics is one of pleasure, you know, in that sense, you know, pure affect. So what I would say is that, you know, that that's what struck me as peculiar, is why he didn't, when he was in this essay, why he didn't write about the unconscious as a writer. Why was it filtered through science? Because I would think that surely a creative person, not just a writer, an artist, is in touch with the unconscious. And I thought, perhaps because I was so, have been so influenced by Blanchot, Foucault, and Deleuze, and all these people, that the best way to think about the unconscious is
so through indirect discourse. Yes, I want to push you on this, because you're returning now to the essay.
Yeah.
I want you to talk about free indirect discourse in Cormac McCarthy, the way in which you see that that arising.
I just simply don't have the expertise to talk about that, because, you know, I you know, you would have to point to certain passages in his work, you know, and I just simply don't have the expertise to say that. You probably have more expertise than I do, or people in this room have.
Well, perhaps that's a bit we could pick up on that in questions or.